I wonder if you could grab your Bibles. There are Bibles in the pew in front of you if you're not in the habit of bringing your own. And I want you to turn to a little book ensconced over near the end of the New Testament called Philippians. Philippians. It's actually a letter, as you find it. I think, in fact, if you're all using the Black Bible, you'll find it on page 955. As you get there, this little book is actually a letter that the Apostle Paul is purported to have written to a church that he started. He had been in the city. He had ministered. There was a woman named Lydia who was a seller of purple dye. She'd been one of the first converts to the church. There had been a young girl possessed with a demon, and she was delivered and brought into the church. And so it had kind of this great beginning. Paul has now been gone many years. The church has continued to grow. I'm sure he still has dear friends that he had gotten to know very well. And at the time Paul is writing this letter, he's in jail. He's awaiting sentencing. Some tradition says that he will be killed. Other tradition says that he was released and then subsequently re-imprisoned. We're not sure. But he is in a prison when he's writing his good friends. And one of the reasons he's writing them is that they had sent him some money. They heard the times were hard, apparently, for Paul, maybe that he was in prison and his needs were met. So this group of old friends had collected an offering for him and sent it to him, and he's kind of writing them a thank you letter. Near the end of this letter, he says some great things throughout it, but I want to go near the end, and I want to look at a couple things he said as he's signing off to dear friends, starting in verse 10. He says, "I rejoice in the Lord that at last you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, I know you've been concerned, but you did not have an opportunity to show it." He's basically saying, thanks for the offering. I kind of wondered what had happened to you guys, and I know you just didn't have the opportunity, but thanks for the gift you have sent. Verse 11. "Now, I'm not saying this because I'm in need, for I have learned to be content in whatever the circumstances." I love what he's saying right there. He's like, hey, this isn't a subtle way of asking for more. I'm fine. I've learned to be content, but I do thank you. Now look what he goes on to say, and this is some powerful stuff. He says, "I know what it is to be in need." You don't have to raise your hand, but some of us know what that's like, to be in need, to have a little more bills than you have income that month. And then he says, "And I know what it is to have plenty." Many of us know what that's like too, when there's actually excess and you actually put a little into savings. But look what he says after this. "I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether I am well fed or whether I'm hungry, whether I'm living in plenty or I'm living in want." Now stop right there. I don't know that I can say that. I can say, yes, I know what it's like to be in need. I know what it's like to have more than I need. But when he goes on and says, "And I've learned to be content in whatever state I have found myself in," that's difficult. When he said hungry, I thought of my kids. My kids have a word for me called hangry. And hangry, some of you will know what it is. It's that mix between hunger and anger. You know, you come, it's a long day, and they know, when they'll be like, "Dad, have you eaten yet?" I'm like, "No, why? I'll ask you later after you eat." Because there's that thing that says, I get kind of aggro if I haven't eaten. I don't want to go there. I don't want that. He says, you know what? I've learned even in that state that I'll be content. And a secret is the last verse. Look at it. In verse 13. "Because I can do everything through Him who gives me strength." My message is entitled today, "When Dreams Become Nightmares." When dreams become nightmares. We're kicking off today, and we'll go over the next couple weeks, what we call our stewardship campaign, where we ask all of us together to look at, what does God have to do with how I live my financial life? What does being a Christian, if anything, have to do with my career, my finances, my budget, my spending? Don't plan your vacation the next couple of weeks. Oh, that's a good week to miss. Because God has a lot to say about the excitement and the freedom that we can experience in our financial lives. Finances are a big part of our lives. I mean, it's one of those things that we tend to do very personally. And yet, it really dictates what we do in our lives or what we cannot do, where we go, where we live, the kind of people we associate with. Much of it is tied to our financial lives. And the good news is that God has a lot of wisdom to give us in how we live out our financial lives. Before I get back to this passage, I was reading, and I don't know if this is true. I read it a couple places, but I'm always suspicious of stories like this. But it says that some years back, the Royal Bank of Scotland sent a pre-approved credit card in the amount of $20,000 to Monty, his last name, Monty Taylor. Good. I wouldn't mind getting one of those. There's many things I wouldn't mind putting on it. $20,000. All you had to do was call in and then, you know, activate the card and you can go. The only problem was that Monty is actually a Shih Tzu dog. And when his owner, Robert, got this to the dog, he's like, score, let's go buy him. And let's buy him everything he ever wanted. A carrier, diamond-studded collar. And then finally figured, no, I don't know if I should do that because the bills will come and I'm not going to be able to pay them off. Little story, if it's true, points to something that is very true, and that is that we live in a world that encourages us to live beyond our means. Okay, I don't know about the world. Let's come back to our culture. Our society definitely encourages us to spend more than most of us really can afford to. I was talking to First Service, and I was saying, you know, in advertising, whether it's on print or in media, certain areas of life, they're very cautious on what you can and can't say. Medicine. If you're going to offer a new medicine that comes out, have you ever listened or read to all the little disclaimers at the end? I mean, they're horrifying. They're like, hey, a new pill that will take care of all your needs. Oh, but it may lead to death and in certain cases maiming for the rest of your life and you'll be missing your limbs. And you're like, huh, great. How do I get some of that? But they're saying, hey, it's not all a panacea. There are things you need to think about. But they don't do that for most advertising. When they show you something that you have to buy, here's a new housing development that's opening, or the new car that gets this many miles per gallon, and it sounds good, and you go and you smell, they do not tell you now before you sign, let's be sure you understand, have you paid all your bills this month? Are you saving for your kids' college education? They don't ask you that stuff. I mean, they don't even want you to think about that stuff. They just want you to get it now because they want you to have it now. And we tend to buy into that kind of instant gratification, and it's dangerous many times. When dreams become nightmares, we're looking this month out of a book called Enough, a wonderful book written by one of our own United Methodist ministers out of, I believe, Kansas City. And he wrote this book, and we're going to look at it over the next month, but he entitled his first chapter this, When Dreams Become Nightmares. And what he was talking about is the American dream. Now, if I were to ask you today at lunch, what is the American dream? I know we could get really philosophical and be like, well, it's what our founding fathers wanted, because we know they talk like this. And it had to do with life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness and freedom for all mankind. And okay, that's part of what the American dream was. For some of you, it's evocative of the civil rights movement, of the American dream for all people of different races. And we can all remember well one of the most famous sermons delivered and messages as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. took those steps and said, I have a dream. That's part of the American dream. But really, most of the time in our culture when we talk about the American dream, we're talking about a financial get-ahead idea where someone came from another country or they came from the back hills of Tennessee, Martin, and they go on and they make it big time, and that is the American dream. It's this pursuit of more. It's this idea of financial getting ahead that really is the American dream. And come on, here on the West Coast, we know that probably better than almost any other part of the country. This part of the world was founded, was populated in the last 150 years by this massive rush of what? There's gold in them there hills, and people came from everywhere to find quick and easy wealth. And that's never stopped. It's part of our society. There's a problem with this. The American dream isn't always all that it's cracked up to be. Over the last couple of years, I don't know about how many of us just got almost scared in the morning to log on to our favorite news site or turn on the radio and hear what was happening today in the economy. What bank is closing today? How much is my house not worth today? Can I afford? Do I have to give this thing back to the bank? I mean, it's been a nightmare. And almost everyone agrees. You know what fueled that? The American dream. We can make big money. We can make fast money. I can buy this and it's going to double by next year because that's what my sister did when she bought hers. And we're going to go. And well, I don't really have enough, but I'll do 100% financing and I'll get this. And you can make it work. And it did not turn out well for us. The American dream. Here's the problem with the American dream. The American dream promises it's something it really cannot deliver. It cannot ultimately give you fulfillment in life. It cannot ultimately sustain happiness in life. Dr. Hamilton, who wrote the book Enough, points to two conditions, he calls them afflictions, in our society that make the American dream very dangerous for us. And the first, he calls affluenza. I know, kind of cute, huh? Something we tend to catch just from being part of our society. Affluenza. And he defines it like this. He says, affluenza is the constant need for more, for bigger, and for better stuff. PBS, on one of their shows, also defined the word as this. They said, affluenza is that bloated, sluggish, unfulfilled feeling that results from efforts to keep up with the Joneses. Have you ever, you don't have to raise your hand, have you ever experienced that kind of feeling? That struggle to keep up with your brother and sister who they just got a new car. Your younger sister, who she got another degree, and so you're going back to school now. And we just go, and we compete. And many times that didn't quite lead us to the fulfillment that we thought it was going to. A philosopher from another country came to visit, stay in the States, and he wrote this. See if you think it's a fair description. He said, Americans are extremely eager in the pursuit of their immediate material pleasures. They're always discontented with the position that they presently occupy. They think about nothing but ways of changing their lot and bettering it. And for people in this frame of mind, every new way of getting wealth, every means of diminishing the cost of production, every invention which makes pleasures easier and greater, seems like the most magnificent accomplishment of the human mind. One usually finds that the love of money is either the chief or the secondary motive at the bottom of everything Americans do. This gives them a family likeness to all their passions and soon makes them rather wearisome to contemplate. Ouch. Yet as I look around at our society, I think he had a point. What surprises me about that is that was written in the 19th century, long, long time ago, by Alexis de Tocqueville, who the French philosopher came and looked at our society. I think he was right. I think from the beginning of especially our culture, it's been one that said, yes, I want freedom not only to worship in my Quaker church, not only freedom, but I want to gain wealth. And people have come from all around the world to not only have civil freedom, but the chance to make money and live the American dream. Affluenza. Problem is, it doesn't always work. We know what it's like to want, to want, to want, then to get it, and to still want, 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 want. I told the first service, go home in your mind right now and open up your closet. Walk in, those of you that are fortunate enough to have a walk-in. The rest of us, be careful when you open the closet door. I kind of look around at some of the things in there, and almost everything in there. At one time, you really, really wanted that thing. You bought it. Some of those things now, you'd be embarrassed if anyone even saw you in it. But at one time, it was worth the hours you spent working to create the money you had to pay for it with. And now, most of that stuff we don't ever wear. Some of that stuff we couldn't have lived without. We spent money, put it on credit card, paid it off in the next year and a half. We were still paying for it when it already had holes, had been faded and bleached in the machine and thrown away. That's part of affluenza. We want more. We want better. I have to stay away from some of those places because it's just tempting. I don't know about you, I'm not a big like Nordstrom's guy, but it's dangerous to walk through Costco. You know what I mean? I go there, my kids are like, Dad, let's go get pizza. Okay, let's go get pizza. That's all we need. There's nothing else in my mind. I don't have a list of stuff I need. We're just going to go get pizza. And while they're cooking, I'm like, let's walk around Costco. Let's get a cart. Well, why do we need a cart? I don't know. Maybe the kids will get tired. And I start walking around and suddenly I'm like, oh my gosh, they have like the new little passbook, the portable hard drive, and it has 1.5 terabytes. I'm not going to use 1.5 terabytes. I haven't filled up my little 200 200 gigabyte thing yet. I haven't even filled that up. But I want the 1.5 because that's big. Think of all the pirated, all the music I could put on that thing. I did get it too. I'm not making that story up. I bought it. And it's sitting there empty. I still use the little one. But we see stuff. And it says, buy me. Take me home. You'll enjoy this. You'll be happy. It seems like next week I'm at Costco again, pushing a cart around those same aisles. What else do they have today that I can't live without? It's just part of it. I don't know. I think part of it is the animal instinct us to collect and to herd. Oh, nuts, 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 nuts. It's going to be a long winter. This is gather a lot of nuts. But there's something else in it that drives us that's not a good thing. The average home in the 1970s, some of you remember, well, I was a child. Okay, maybe not a child, but in the 70s, the average home was a little over 1,600 square feet. Now the average home is almost 2,400 square feet. That's considerably larger. And yet, today we have in our nation that did not exist in the mid-70s, 2 billion square feet of storage space built around the cities. Aren't those pretty places you drive by them? All the stuff that we just have to have, even though we can't use it, we can't get to it, we have to keep that stuff. Our houses are full, our closets are full, our garages are full, we can't even get our cars in. Don't look under our beds. And yet we have storage units for more stuff because that makes us happy. I love going down there and paying that bill every month and putting more stuff in there. But something in us says we have to have affluenza, that bloated feeling, my life is so full of stuff. Because isn't that what life's about? No. The other problem is this. He said not only affluenza, but creditis. Oops. That is kind of medley today, huh? Creditis. Don't we love credit cards? You don't even have to pay for it now. Just enjoy it now. Worry about it later. That's really what that concept is for many Americans. Is buy now, take responsibility for it sometime in the future. Very dangerous. It's coming to that part of mankind, humankind, that is so present with us always and always gets us into trouble, is that like for instant gratification. This is one of those points of convergence that all world religions come together on. Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity. The warning that instant gratification is a dangerous way to live your lives. Because many times it interferes with greater lasting gratification that must be delayed. But credit cards are so easy, and they send them. Years ago, when I was really young, it was already on the way out, but I still remember it. They had this thing called layaway. Remember that? They had it at like Sears and at Kmart. And you could go and say, well, I'd like to buy that by the end. I think one of the first things I bought on layaway was, this is really geeky, but I bought a rotor tiller. I was in school still, but I wanted this rotor tiller that would till up my garden. And I remember I didn't have the money, so my parents took me down, and I paid money. And all summer long, my harvest season was going by, but I was putting money. And I was so excited when I finally put the last of the money, and I could take that thing home. You actually paid for it, and then you enjoyed it. But now they got this idea that, hey, as long as you can get approved, just go pick it up now and worry about it sometime in the future. There is a fundamental problem. When, if how you're living your life today, you can't afford it, what's going to happen in 3 months that you suddenly can't afford it? Dangerous. But creditis, it's a muck in our society. 20 years ago, the average credit card individual balance was $3,000. Today, it's over $9,000. And because many people do pay off monthly, that means that that $9,000 balance is actually a lot higher on many of our cards. Further good news is that many of them today only say you only have to pay 2% off every month. So, if you have $9,000 and you pay the minimum, you can pay that card off in 240 years. Why you've been paying 18% interest on it. And that little thing that you couldn't live without, but it was such a good deal because it was 60% off, you will have paid 125% more by the time you finally pay that off. Wow. And yet, our society now is driven its economy by credit. Danger, danger, danger. What is the root of this? It really is a spiritual root, I believe. I believe that the Bible teaches that we were created in God's image. God impressed God's image upon us. And what that means is that there is a need and a desire for us to have a relationship with God. Go throughout the cultures of the world. Pick up your old anthropology book from high school or college. I don't care where they were, what continent, there was this need and this desire for humankind to somehow be in contact with that which was above and greater and beyond the temporal of our lives. That's how we were created. And when we decide that that's not the most important thing in our life, there is this missing piece that says, then really, what is my purpose here in life? How do I define who I am, what I am? Where is my worth coming from if it's not deeply centered in just the fact that God made me in God's image? Well, it's in the stuff I have. It's in how successful I am in the eyes of others. It's in how I look in comparison to others. And yet that never ultimately works. We've had it. We've had the nicest stuff at times, in ways, at times. And yet, there's still that need. Jesus said this. He said, seek first my kingdom. Make your first priority being in a right place with God. And those other things will be added to you. You don't have to make them your priority in life. If living a right life before God, if being spiritually right with our Creator is your goal, you'll watch how those other parts of your life will begin to line up in a good place. It's not easy because everything around us says, no. That's too transcendent. That's too invisible. How does that really fulfill you? Going to church and praying and all that? You need a faster car today. The Bible also warns us when Jesus said, beware. The thief comes to steal, to kill, and to destroy from you. But Jesus said, I've come that you might have abundant life. Now, I don't know what your view on the devil is, whether you think it's a literal being or whether to you it's a personification of the forces that draw us away from God and from God's will. Needless to say, when the Bible speaks about the devil wanting to destroy and mess up your life, those things, forces are really at work in our lives. And it doesn't have to be something like an affair to ruin your marriage. It doesn't have to be something like some horrible addiction to some drug that's affecting your... It can be nothing more than getting you to buy into the American dream that if I just make more money and if I just spend more, I will be happier. We are on a slippery slope when we believe that. I'm not against things. I think God enjoys seeing us prosper in life and whatever that may mean. I'm talking about what's the priority in our hearts. Spiritually, Jesus said this in Mark 8, what does it profit if a person gains the whole world but loses his or her soul? We don't have to think very hard through American history to think of people who had won so much of the American dream. Wealthy, famous, huge houses, and to look at the shipwreck of their lives. Not them all, but many. Have we not learned that then maybe that's not what brings happiness? Maybe it's in our lives being rooted in more transcendent purposes, believing that we have an eternal purpose, believing that being in communication with God gives us values like generosity and peace and patience and long-suffering and mercy that don't instantly gratify us, but wow, give us true lasting contentment and fulfillment and identity. What's the solution as I conclude? It begins with a changed heart. How do I do that? That's where you ask God. That's where we come as disciples of God and we're like, God, please change my heart. I like things. I like now. I like more. I like better. I like faster. I like bigger. Lord, please begin to change my heart. And I believe that the Holy Spirit can begin to help you change those habits, those lifelong habits for many of us. How else? You've got to begin to fight it actively. It's easy to look at the catalogs and buy online, on TV, in the store. They're advertising everywhere now. I cannot believe it. I walked in a parking garage the other day, and all along the walls in the parking garage were big advertisements. I mean, everywhere. What are you doing to combat that? How about find a way that you can spend your time, your resources, your money in a way that's not on you? And challenge yourself. Periodically in my life, I do this exercise, and I'll be honest, it's hard for me. to find something that I really like and give it away. Because you know how it's easy when they're like, we're collecting for you know those in need. Bring your sweaters and your jackets. We go to our closet and we get like the nasty thing that we don't want to wear anymore. It's out of style. You wouldn't catch me dead in that jacket anymore. I just haven't thrown it away. I'm going to give it to the people in need. How about take the nice new one you just got? Ouch! That hurts. Maybe it's good once in a while to do something to just kind of give a wake-up call to, wait a minute, am I too attached to things? Because they don't ultimately... And I bet if you do it, even though it might smack a little bit, there's this sudden freeing sense of, you know what? Things don't have control over me in my life. The purpose that I want to be generous and self-sacrificial, that trumped this time. And that feels good. I think today we begin by saying, Lord, you see my heart better than I do. How can I simplify in areas of my life? How can I check that onslaught of more, of instant? And how can I be a person of purpose in the kingdom? We live in a world surrounded by influences telling us something different. Help us to remember that we want to seek those things that are part of your kingdom. We want to seek to be like you, and you promised that you would add those other things to our lives. Help us. We ask it in Jesus' name. And with our heads bowed, can we all pray the prayer together that Jesus taught us to pray? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.